When I was a little boy, my brother and I had a record of Bible songs. And we used to perform to this record, forcing our parents and any other adults who had unfortunately wandered into the house when we had created one of our performances. So there was, for example, a song about Samson that began, "His arms as big as melons, his shoulders hard as rocks." And we used to put something under the sleeves of our bathrobes or whatever and walk around with biceps that we still don't have to this Samson song. And then there was a song about Daniel. And the refrain went like this: Dan, Dan, Daniel came out of Israel, called on the good Lord and prayed. Mighty King Rosenfeld, because of Daniel, that's what the Bible tells, that's what the Bible say. Now we went and pranced about singing about Mighty King Rosenfeld for many years. And while it might be that not all of you are experts on Jewish history, my guess is that none of you, if asked, could say anything about the history and career of Mighty King Rosenfeld. Because, as you have probably surmised, there was no Mighty King Rosenfeld. And when we listened to this song as we got older, we realized, and I remember the moment at which we looked at each other with both hilarity and embarrassment, that it was Mighty Kings Rose and Fell. But for us, it will always be Mighty King Rosenfeld. I bring this up because the idea that mighty kings rose and fell is central to our parsha this morning and to an idea that actually should animate our behavior as human beings and as Jews. In our parsha this morning, there is discussion of kingship, as there is throughout the book of Deuteronomy. But it is a very ambivalent attitude towards this institution that characterized not just the ancient world, but the entire world until very recently. Whether emperors, czars, or kings, it was not really until the 18th century that it occurred to people that it was possible to set up a system without a king. And yet, even though it took thousands of years for government to reach that conclusion, in the Bible you see the great uneasiness of the Jewish people towards the idea of a king. And in fact, for much of our history, and for all of the Torah, we rule ourselves without a human king. Moshe is not a king. Abraham is not a king. In fact, the kings that we do meet in the Torah are called Pharaoh, which lets you know that this idea of a king is an uncomfortable one. And then, when both modern scholarship and Jewish law reinforces it, you're really onto something. Let's start with modern scholarship. The Bible, you know, is built as a covenant, a brit, a contract. God says, if you obey my laws, I'll do this, this, and this. And we say, in return, you're going to do this and this and this for us. Right? It is what scholars call a suzerainty treaty. And in the ancient Near East, it was very familiar. Other places had treaties between God and the king, in which God would say, if the king does this, I'll do that. And, of course, the king would promise in return. Except the problem is, in Israel, there's no king. So who is God making the treaty with? It seems with the people, not with Moshe. After all, he's not asking Moshe for specific obligations. Rather, God's making a treaty with an entire people, which means that God is effectively bypassing kingship and going straight to the nation. Not only that, but when Israel gets kings, as we do, the greatest among the Israelite kings are not distinguished for what kings are usually distinguished for. It's true that David and Solomon had military victories. But really, what do we remember David for? David is, first of all, the author of the Psalms and the forerunner of the Messiah. In other words, of a time of peace. And Solomon is renowned for being the wisest human being in the world. And according to the Jewish tradition, three of the books of the Tanakh were written by Solomon. Three biblical books. When he was young, he wrote the Song of Songs, the passionate love song. In middle age, he wrote Proverbs, which is a book of sort of homespun wisdom. And in old age, he wrote Ecclesiastes, which is a book both of disillusionment and of faith. That's what we remember Solomon for. That's unusual in human history. Even those kings that are remembered for other achievements, for example, Alfred the Great, the only king accorded the title Great in English history. Alfred the Great was a remarkable scholar. Alfred the Great was the one who translated books from Latin to English, which in that age, in the 800s, was almost unheard of for a human being, much less a king. But what he's remembered for is beating back the Vikings. That's what made him great. The idea that learning and poetry and song makes a king great, it's a very Jewish idea. And the idea that ultimately, there won't be an earthly king in the sense that we conceive of it, also comes out of this ambivalence, this feeling that kings should be and shouldn't be. That's why in our Parsha and in Deuteronomy, what do we learn about a king? A king has to write out a Sefer Torah. In fact, according to Rashi, a king has to write two Torahs, because a king always has to be aware that he is subordinate, not sovereign. That his will and his ideas are under the wisdom of God, not over the people. A king during prayer is supposed to be bowed down through the entire prayer, because he's supposed to be humble and not all-powerful. The reason that this is so is that Judaism really does believe in kings. But it doesn't believe that no one should be a king. It believes that everyone is a king. That's why God goes to the Israelite people for the covenant. Not because there are no kings, but because everyone is sovereign. That's why service to the king Pharaoh is illegitimate. Because you can only serve Melech Malchei Hamlachim, the king who is the king of kings, that is God. And who serves directly under God? We do, all of us. No intermediary, no king. God doesn't cut any deals or covenants with anyone else. You know that old story that illustrates this so well about Ben-Gurion and Truman, where Truman says to Ben-Gurion in his office one day, he says, you don't know what it's like to be the president of 250 million people. And Ben-Gurion says, with all due respect, sir, you don't know what it's like to be the president of 3 million presidents. Right? I mean, that's that sense of oneself as a king. This is very, very, it's not just a joke, though, and it's not just a social idea. It's a theological idea. Abraham Joshua Heschel used to repeat all the time the Hasidic saying that the greatest sin a human being can commit is to forget that he's a king. And whether, depending on which way you want to spin it, either she's a king or she's a queen. Because that idea implies certain responsibilities. Being a king is not just power. Being a king means, among other things, that what you care about is more than just yourself. that you extend beyond your own responsibility. After all, you're a king. You're responsible for everyone. It means that your actions have consequences. Kings can't do things lightly. What they do matters. They have to deliberate. It means that you are responsible for the collective in the way that we see in our parsha. That if somebody is found who has been murdered in the city, what do the elders of the city have to do? They have to go out and have a ceremony that says, "We didn't do this." And all the commentators say, "Well, who ever thought that the elders did?" And the point is that the atmosphere that you create in your city is your responsibility. That, as Heschel put it, in continuation of this same idea, not everyone is guilty, but everyone is responsible. That's part of the burden of kingship. And as a king, what is your great task? Your great task is to raise up a successor. And that too is implicit in the Jewish idea, to teach our children, because they're going to take the kingdom from us. And one day they will have the responsibilities of sovereignty, and they'll have to be kings. That idea of kingship leads to a veneration for human life and a belief that every human being is not just valuable but invaluable. And that though we are all different, we all share sovereignty. So, I suppose what I want to say is that we were right. There was a mighty King Rosenfeld. That's, by the way, why on Rosh Hashanah that we're about to approach, what shape are the chalot? Why? Because around challah is a crown. Because it is the day of malchut, the day of kingship. And when Rosenfeld sits at his table, he's a king. And so is everyone else. There's a King Rosenfeld. There's a King Burke. There's a King Matlub. There's a King Isaacs and a King Elihu. Everyone is a king. It makes board meetings difficult. But it makes faith strong. So as we approach the time of kingship, Rosh Hashanah, let's remember that it's not about only being faithful to the King of Kings, but being faithful to the King. And that is each one of us. But not only in our power, also in our obligation, in our responsibility, and in our faith. Shabbat Shalom.